talk about some work done together with David Moroz, who is a postdoc at Caltech right now, Sentil, who is in the audience, and Subir, who will be in the audience. All right. I'll be talking mostly about physics of metals or phases of matter that resemble metals. And let me just very quickly remind you that our understanding of metals is based on Landau Fermi liquid theory, which says that the excitations in an interacting electron fluid are continuously connected to those in a non-interacting electron gas. In particular, the low energy excitations live near a surface in momentum space known as the Fermi surface. And if you look at the fermion-Green's function near the Fermi surface, it has the same pole-like structure as in a non-interacting electron gas, except the quasi-particle residue and the Fermi velocity can renormalize due to the interactions. Okay, so one of the central questions in condensed matter physics is how can this Fermi liquid theory break down? And in particular, one might wonder whether it can break down in such a way that there is still a sharp notion of Fermi surface where gapless excitations reside. However, these excitations are not ordinary Landau quasi-particles. So I'll refer to such states of matter as critical Fermi surface states. Now, in one dimension, we know of such critical Fermi surface states. They are nothing but Luttinger liquids. However, in dimension larger than one, there are still a lot of open questions surrounding the existence of such phases. Okay. Nevertheless, there are several contexts in which the presence of such critical Fermi surface states has been proposed. Perhaps the simplest one of these conceptually is the context of quantum phase transitions in metals. Another context is the spin-on Fermi surface state of MOT insulators that Matthew mentioned during his colloquium yesterday. And yet another system where such states might occur is the Halpin-Lee-Reed state of the quantum Hall fluid at filling factor 1/2. And there are several others, but I think this is a representative list. So let me begin with the first one of these, the study of quantum phase transitions in metals. So imagine that you start with a metal with some symmetry, and suppose the interactions are weak. If the interactions are weak, first of all, the symmetry will not be spontaneously broken. Symmetry will be preserved, and moreover, the system will be described by Fermi liquid theory. Now imagine that we start increasing the strength of the interactions until at some point the system decides that it likes to spontaneously break the symmetry and develop a certain order. So we can introduce a corresponding order parameter, and in this phase we have a finite expectation value for that order parameter. Now an ordered metal is still a metal, can still be described by Fermi liquid theory. So both phases, both the disordered phase here and the ordered phase here, are Fermi liquids. However, at the transition point between the two, at the so-called quantum critical point, we often expect non-Fermi liquid behavior to arise. And the reason for that is that at the quantum critical point, the fluctuations of the order parameter are very strong. These fluctuations couple to the electron excitations in the vicinity of the Fermi surface, scatter them, and destroy the Landau quasiparticles. And there are a number of materials which seem to fit into this phase diagram. So electron-doped cuprates, recently discovered iron-based superconductors, or so-called nictites, certain heavy fermion compounds, strontium ruthenate, perhaps, and certain organics. Yes?
You require Fermi surface area to change as you have phase transitions
no.
for this to happen.
No, it doesn't. Not necessarily.
I see.
I'll come back to this maybe. So just to flash phase diagrams of some of these materials, indeed they seem to have, so here's for example the nictide, the iron arsenic superconductor. Here is the electron doped cuprate. Here is a hole doped cuprate. Here is strontium ruthenate. They seem to have an ordered phase, a disordered phase, and some strange region in between above what looks like a quantum phase transition. Yes? So in electron doped cuprates, it's not clear that there is a pseudo gap. So the hole doped cuprate here is the most speculative, and we don't quite know which type of order, if there is a quantum critical point at optimal doping, what type of order might be responsible for it. Every order known to man has been detected in the underdoped regime, and so this is very speculative. But I think in the iron based superconductors and in the electron doped cuprates, the situation is much more clear, and this picture is on a fairly solid footing. Okay, so in this red region here above the what looks like a quantum critical point, many different non-Fermi liquid signatures are seen depending on the material, and the most commonly measured property in condensed matter systems is the resistivity, as you all know. And the resistivity of an ordinary Fermi liquid grows as the square of temperature. So this is denoted in blue here. And you see that on the two sides of the putative phase transition, we have indeed Fermi liquid-like resistivity. However, in this fan-like region above the quantum critical above the putative phase transition, we find that the resistivity grows linearly with temperature. So this is known as a strange metal behavior, and it is a huge puzzle in the field. I think essentially this is still a mystery, and I will not be able to elucidate this mystery in the present talk. Okay, now theoretically phase transitions in metals can be divided into two categories depending on whether the system breaks the translational symmetry or not, that is, on whether the order parameter carries a finite wave vector or a zero wave vector. And in this class with zero wave vector, we have such familiar orders as a ferromagnet, for instance, and maybe a little bit more exotic orders, such as the pneumatic order that I will come back to in a second. Whereas in this other class where the order parameter carries a finite wave vector, we have essentially modulated orders, such as charge, density wave, and spin density wave order. Now, the reason for the division into these two classes is that order parameter fluctuations couple quite differently to the electrons in the two cases. For the case of the second class, order parameter fluctuations couple most strongly to isolated points on the Fermi surface, which are connected by the ordering wave vector. And at those points are known as hotspots. And those hotspots is where one expects to find the strongest non-Fermi liquid singularities at the quantum critical point. Whereas for this first class of transitions, the order parameter fluctuations can effectively couple to the entire Fermi surface, and one expects to lose Landau quasiparticles on the entire Fermi surface. So in this talk, I will constrain myself to this first class of transitions. They appear to be simple theoretically. I will concentrate as an example on this pneumatic transition. So let me remind you what pneumatic order is. Pneumatic order corresponds to spontaneous breaking of rotational symmetry of the system without breaking off translational symmetry. So like in a liquid crystal, for instance. Except here, we are going to be thinking about this pneumatic order in the presence of a lattice, not in the continuum. So imagine that I am in two dimensions, and I have a square lattice. So I have a 90-degree rotational symmetry. And as long as this symmetry is unbroken, the Fermi surface of my system of my metal will respect the 90 degree rotation symmetry, but it might become energetically favorable as I tune some parameter for the Fermi surface to distort, spontaneously breaking the rotational symmetry. So then I have two degenerate ground states characterized by Fermi surface distorting along x and y directions. So there is an order parameter for this type of symmetry breaking, which is just a real scalar field phi, an Ising order parameter, which transforms under 90 degree rotational symmetry. And these two ground states have opposite values of order parameter. So actually, such order is observed in a number of materials, for instance, in the iron nictides that I showed you before, and in the whole doped cuprates. Now, so there is some motivation for studying it. The real motivation, though, is that this is a theoretically tractable example of a quantum critical point in a metal, and we will essentially be able to completely describe this quantum phase transition. Okay. So that was one example of critical Fermi surface states. Another example arises in a very different context. This is the spin-on Fermi surface state of mod insulators. So this state was already mentioned by Matthew yesterday. So now we change gears, and we are not thinking about metals, but we are thinking about insulators. So in an insulator of electrons, the charge degree of freedom of electron is completely quenched. The electrons are localized. However, the spin degrees of freedom are the relevant excitations. And one can have various exotic phases associated with the spin degrees of freedom, known generally as spin liquids. So one way to describe these phases is to start with the electron spin operators and to fractionalize them into these fermionic spin-ons, F. And these fermionic spin-ons have a spin 1/2 but charge 0. So they're fractional excitations. Electrons have a spin 1/2 but charge 1. And these guys, although they have a spin 1/2, they're neutral. So these are kind of exotic excitations. And I imagine that these are spin-ons become the relevant degrees of freedom in the insulator that I'm trying to describe. Now, it turns out that such a description in terms of the spin-on operators always comes together with a U1 gauge invariance. We can rotate the phase of these spin-ons locally. So whenever these spin-on degrees of freedom appear, they come together with an emergent U1 gauge field, which I will denote as little a. So so we are describing here a phase with emergent fractional excitations and emergent gauge fields. And now I imagine that these fractional excitations, these spin-ons, form a Fermi surface. As fermions, they can do that. But this Fermi surface of spin-ons will not be described by Fermi liquid theory, because there is this U1 gauge field around, which is gapless. And this U1 gauge field interacts with the spin-ons near the Fermi surface, again destroying the well-defined Landau quasi-particle. And there is some numerical evidence that such a phase might be present on the triangular lattice in a Hubbert model at intermediate U over T. And there are also materials, there are insulators that that are candidates for realizing this phase, and this were also mentioned yesterday by Matthew. Okay, right. So I've mentioned several examples of systems where critical Fermi surface states are expected to appear, phase transitions in metals, a spin-on Fermi surface state where we have a critical Fermi surface, but not of electrons, but rather of spin-ons. And I also mentioned the composite fermion liquid in the quantum Hall fluid. I will not talk about it explicitly, but formally it shares many similarities with this spin-on Fermi surface problem. Okay, so these three states, they clearly arise in very different physical contexts, but they share a rather similar theoretical description. Essentially, they involve an interaction of a Fermi surface with a gapless bosonic mode, either an order parameter in the case of phase transitions in metals, or the emergent gauge field in these two other cases. And it turns out that this is actually a difficult problem, in part due to an absence of a full renormalization group understanding. And this is a kind of problem that comes back to haunt us in every generation. This problem has been proposed to have been solved many times, initially by Hertz in the 70s, who said that essentially at low energies, this problem is exactly solvable and we can all go home. Okay, then in the early 90s, it was realized by various people that things are not as wonderful, or from a different perspective, boring. And actually, one cannot solve this problem exactly generally, but it was claimed to have been solved in a large N limit where one promotes the number of fermion flavors to be N and to be large. So that was the status of the problem for many years until Sang Sik came along and showed that this solution is actually incorrect. The large N expansion fails for the present problem, and the problem has been declared open again. And since then, there have been a number of both technical and conceptual developments in the field that I'd like to tell you about. Okay, and there is a particular aspect of the problem that I'd like to focus on, which is that we know that an ordinary Fermi liquid is unstable to an arbitrarily weak attractive interaction in the Cooper channel, in the BCS channel. So such attractive interaction drives electron pairing and leads to superconductivity. So the question I'd like to ask is whether critical Fermi surface states are stable to Cooper pairing. And here we have to distinguish the case of quantum phase transitions in metals and that of these exotic spin and charge liquids. So for quantum phase transitions in metals, we observe that typically order parameter fluctuations mediate attraction in the Cooper channel, at least in some Cooper channel. For the pneumatic quantum critical point, this attraction actually appears in all angular momentum and spin channels. So now we are facing a fundamental problem. As we approach the quantum critical point, the fluctuations of the order parameter become stronger and stronger. So the pairing glue mediated by the order parameter becomes stronger and stronger. However, the same order parameter fluctuations which provide the pairing glue are also responsible for destroying the very quasi-particles that are trying to pair. So these are two competing effects. And the question is, which one of these competing effects wins? In particular, is a quantum critical point in a metal inherently unstable to superconductivity? Is it always hidden underneath a superconducting dome? And there are many materials where, indeed, the putative quantum critical point is hidden underneath the superconducting dome. This includes cuprate, iron arsenic, and certain heavy fermion materials. So it's very suggestive that the quantum critical point in the metal might be indeed unstable to superconductivity. Okay, now for the problem of, say, the spin-on Fermi surface state, the situation is rather different. Remember, here the analog of gapless boson interacting with the electrons is the gauge field, the U1 gauge field. Now, in the presence of a Fermi surface, we all know that longitudinal fluctuations of the electric field are debye-screened. So they become gapped, and we can essentially forget about them. However, fluctuations of the magnetic field in the presence of a Fermi surface are not screened. They remain gapless, although they're strongly Landau damped. And this magnetic, but it turns out that these magnetic field fluctuations, they mediate a long-range repulsion in the Cooper channel. So to understand that, remember that magnetic field fluctuations mediate a current-current interaction. Now, currents on opposite sides of the Fermi surface are opposite, and we know from Ampere's law that opposite currents repel. So these gapless gauge fluctuations mediate a long-range repulsion between the fermions, and therefore are not expected to cause a pairing instability of the spin on Fermi surface. However, generally, in addition to these long-range interactions mediated by the gauge field, we expect that there will be short-range interactions between the fermions present as well. And in principle, these short-range interactions can be attractive. So the question then is, can an attractive short-range four-Fermi interaction V compete with this repulsive long-range interaction mediated by the gauge field? And if so, what is the critical strength of the short-range interaction which is needed to drive a transition to a paired phase? Okay, so generally we can imagine the following phase diagram where we start with the spin on Fermi surface phase, and as long as the short-range interaction between spinons is not too attractive, then this phase is stable, and we have gapless spinon excitations as well as gapless magnetic gauge field fluctuations. However, at some critical value of short-range interaction between the spinons, some presumably attractive value, the spinons will decide to pair up. So there will be an expectation value of this spinon pair operator. So this spinon pair operator will break the U1 gauge symmetry down to a Z2 subgroup. And in the process, the spinon excitations will become gapped, just as electrons during Cooper pairing become gapped, become Bogoliubov excitations, gapped Bogoliubov excitations. And in addition, the gauge field will undergo a Higgs mechanism. So the gauge fluctuations will also become gapped, and the gauge excitations in this resulting effective Z2 gauge theory will appear in the form of magnetic flux tubes, analogous to Abrikosov vortices in a superconductor. And in the context of this kind of spin liquid physics, such excitations are known as Voisons. Okay, so such a kind of general picture is easy to imagine. Theoretically, the real issue is whether this phase transition can be continuous. And previous theoretical work by Ubens and Lee claimed that the phase transition is always driven first order by gauge field fluctuations. And I'll show that this is actually incorrect. I'll give a systematic renormalization group calculations which demonstrate that a continuous second-order phase transition is possible, and I'll describe the properties of this phase transition, such as critical exponents and so forth. Yes?
I mean, why would there be a U1 gauge field in the first place as opposed to a Z2 gauge field? There's no obvious symmetry the conserved charge-like symmetry that the spins have that would want them to have. Well, they can fractionalize just as well with a Z2, which is the natural thing for fermion fractionalization. Why
do you want? This is true. However, so this is just.
It must be some physical analog of charge conservation that would kind of give you a U1. There's no obvious physical symmetry or physical property that would well, fermion number, which would come about when you fractionalize, requires Z2, but SC1 you want to require. These are like partitions.
So first of all, this is one phase that one can obtain, right? And
what would be the interpretation if there wasn't in one phase
of the U1 conserved quantity? What is it?
So you're asking what is this
what's
chart?
The number that's conserved? What the number of what's the kind of number like conserved quantity that such a fractionalization would apply?
So this is just some emergent conservation law, just the same as in a Z2 spin liquid, right? The flux is conserved, the Z2 flux.
Yeah, but
the number
Z2
of
is natural, but U1 isn't.
Well,
I
don't see
both are equally natural.
I don't see why
like some kind of conserved charge number.
No, these are not physical symmetries. These are gauge.
It's a gauge.
So it's true that that this could be some kind of a that one can also have phases with an emergent Z2 gauge field, and somehow the microscopics of the problem will determine which one is favored.
If Z2 looks natural for fermions, if you are U1, why not E8?
I guess E8 is just as natural as U1.
I guess you need to see which person looks the fine.
Yeah. The question is
whether
there is some kind of a measurement. For example, you say appearance of a spin-on fermion surface means U1, but need to look at your spin-on fermion surface.
No,
maybe there's something more concrete that can measure. So,
U1
is a relativity theorem, and without a U1, there's no relativity theorem.
No, they will have very different properties, right? So if you have, there are certain Z2 states with a stable Fermi surface,
yeah.
But those Z2 states, basically the excitations are just Fermi liquid-like excitations.
Exactly.
And here we will see that we will have non-Fermi liquid-like behavior of this. SC2, I think, actually will generally be unstable to pairing
the Fermi liquid, you have some exponent. Maybe the spinning, some kind of exponent different. You want to have some special exponent.
Exactly.
If you tune the spins with some other gauge field, I mean, once you play gauge field games, you've got a large number. You can start to, you can presumably write down a fractionalization with lots of different gauge fields if you want it mathematically.
But there is also a nice.
V2 is fermion
fractionalization. No, first of all, I don't know what. Matthew said in his talk yesterday, but the triangular lattice Hubbard mode near the mode transition, it's very well motivated microscopically to have a U1 state.
Right, so you can think of this as not fractionalizing spins, but actually fractionalizing electrons. And then you can think of it as spin-charge separation. And there it's quite natural to have this U1 representation where you write an electron as. This model doesn't know, but you can think of this. There are these dot 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 terms in the Hamiltonian, all right? So of course, if you are very deep in the insulating phase and if you have a triangular lattice, we know that it actually orders antiferromagnetically. But when you are close to a phase transition to a metal, so as you increase the strength of T over U, you get this all sorts of other types of terms, which you can derive from a Hubbard model, such as ring exchange terms and higher ring exchange terms. So there are charge fluctuations, and this, if you think of it approaching from an insulating side, those charge fluctuations give rise to all these dot 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 terms, which kind of. Well, it will not strictly speaking relate to a physical electric charge, but in some sense, in this U1, right, there is. Let me just say one more thing. In this U1, there is a kind of a background. There is a background electric charge which neutralizes the charge of the spinons, and that background electric charge emergent electric charge is actually the same as the number of sites in the lattice. So it's some manifestation of the commensurability of the Mott insulating state.
If we make a comment, long back Brendan Green showed that the magnetic flux associated with this RVBU and gauge field is a spin chirality. So there is a physical quantity. We can discuss.
No. I think the question wasn't about how to interpret the gauge field, but how to interpret the gauge current. If I understood correctly.
That's the spin current.
Spin current.
Well,
that
would
be a
C
current, right?
It's
not a spin current.
So what Ganapati is saying is that.
Maybe we should let Max.
Yeah.
This is a philosophical question we can be asked about the same time.
Actually, you have to distinguish the two from one. You look at the two from one. You look at the monopole of the radio on the
okay,
even here we have monopole operators of any charge.
Mm-hmm.
And Z2 will only have Z2 charge. Monopole operators.
This will be the 2D analog, what he has written down.
Okay, so maybe we can have a discussion afterwards, but let me try to continue. Right. Okay, so I claim that this type of phase transition can be second order, and I'll describe its properties. Okay, so now let me tell you about our present understanding of the theory of these critical Fermi surface states. And let me, as an example, use this isognomatic transition that I introduced earlier. So as I said, all these states I'm considering essentially involve an interaction of some boson with the Fermi surface. And here, the boson is this isognomatic order parameter, which is just a scalar field. So the action of the theory has three components. There is some electron dispersion. There are the order parameter fluctuations. And then there is a Yukawa-like coupling between this order parameter and the fermions.
So the UMP you're talking about is the compact UMP or non-compact?
Compact. It always emerges as compact.
How about this instant sector summation? It's you get a confinement phase.
Well, so you get confinement phase if you have gapped matter fields. Here you have gapless matter fields, and you actually have infinitely many of them each point.
You don't need a large limit. You can prove it's
so there are. It's strongly believed that it's deconfined. Going back to work, kind of RPA work, but also more systematic work by Sangsik.
But it's a strict proof, or it's just an argument.
I think by the standards of the talk, it's a proof. but I'm glad Zheng Han is not here.
And also this VBS neo transition you can prove is different. And there are some reason like if it's proliferated by 4 or some kind of become dangerous irrelevant. So do you have similar story?
So what you're referring to is if you have usually in relativistic theories like CPN model or if you have a gapless Dirac cone, usually if you have enough matter fields, so if you have n components and if n is large, then there is some critical n beyond which it becomes deconfined. But here there are actually infinite. Yeah, Fermi surface is always kind of infinitely many, n equal to strictly to infinity in this sense. So so it's believed that monopole correlation function decay in some exponential manner. It's actually some interesting exponential exponent of x to some power, and I think. So there is interesting physics involved there, but I think it's almost certain that this is not a problem. Instantons are not a problem. Right. So there is this Yukawa interaction, which gives all the juice. All right. So To get some intuition about this problem, let me just begin by treating it with random phase approximation or at kind of one loop level. So we know that in the presence of a Fermi surface, order parameter fluctuations can decay into a particle hole pair, so they become Landau damped, strongly damped. And this Landau damping leads to the effective dynamics of the order parameter becoming very slow at low energies. So essentially, this at the quantum critical point, the order parameter has a dynamical critical. The order parameter fluctuations have a dynamical critical exponent z equal to 3. So now we can look at what happens if we consider the feedback of this slow order parameter fluctuations on the electrons. And if you just compute this simple one loop diagram, we find that the electron self-energy goes as a frequency to 2/3. So this is clear non-Fermi liquid behavior. It implies that the Fermi velocity and the quasi-particle residue go to zero at the quantum critical point. And in fact, if you look at the electron spectral weight at the quantum critical point, we find that there are some very broad excitations, which are essentially as whose width is the same as their characteristic energy. So this the electron excitations at the quantum critical point become incoherent, should be compared to a Fermi liquid, where the width of electron excitations goes as energy squared or energy squared log energy, which is much smaller than the mean energy, so the excitations are sharp and well defined. Okay. So this was just a very simple-minded random phase approximation treatment of the problem. Now let me come back and try to build a systematic renormalization group theory of the transition. And here we run into a conceptual difficulty. Namely, if you look at the order parameter part of the action, it suggests that we should scale all momenta towards zero, just as it's done in classical theory of critical phenomena as taught to us by Wilson. However, if you look at the fermion part of the action, it says that we should scale momenta towards the Fermi surface, as taught to us by Shankar. So the question is how to combine these very different types of scalings. And here, a physical input turns out to be very, very important. Namely, if you look at an order parameter fluctuation with a given direction of wave vector, q, this fluctuation couples most strongly to two patches of the Fermi surface to which q is nearly tangent. And essential reason for this is that the order parameter fluctuations are very slow, very soft. So if the fluctuation comes along at some arbitrary angle to the Fermi surface, it takes the electron very far from the Fermi surface, and yet the energy it provides it is very small, is insufficient to kind of return the electron on shell. So such processes are inefficient. However, if the fluctuation comes along at a grazing incidence to the Fermi surface, it gives a much smaller energy. The final electron state here is a lot closer to the Fermi surface, and turns out that the order parameter fluctuation supplies the kind of the right amount of energy to make such processes resonant. So these are this is the dominant coupling of the order parameter to the fermions. Okay, so this motivates the following construction. Let's take our Fermi surface and let's divide it into pairs of antipodal patches, like so. And for each patch pair, we'll consider the interaction of electrons in those two patches with order parameter fluctuations whose momentum is preferentially tangent to the patch. So we expand the fermion dispersion in these two patches. Here is the order parameter fluctuations. And here is the Yukawa coupling between the order parameter and the fermions psi plus and psi minus living in the two patches. And here we're making a key assumption, which is that the coupling between different pairs of patches can be neglected. And this assumption appears to be reasonable for the description of the kind of non-Fermi liquid properties of the state, but they will need, it will need to be revisited when we talk about the pairing instability, the superconducting instability. Okay, so we have this two-patch theory. The patches are assumed to decouple. And then how do we do scaling? How do we do RG in this two-patch theory? Well, this can be read off from the kinetic term of the fermion, which essentially says that, so we're starting with these two patches. And in the RG process, we will shrink both the width and the thickness of the two patches. And this is very different from how RG is done in a Fermi liquid, where only the direction radial to the Fermi surface is scaled. OK, so armed with this RG procedure, what can we learn? Well, first of all, we learned that essentially all order parameter and electron correlation functions involve just two critical exponents, a dynamical critical exponent z and a fermion anomalous dimension eta f. So z, for instance, enters the boson correlation function and the specific heat, while eta f also enters the fermion Green's function. And at RPA level, which I described just earlier, the dynamical critical exponent z is equal to 3, and the fermion anomalous dimension is 0. And for a long time, people thought that these critical exponents obtained in RPA are exact. OK, but how do we actually calculate these critical exponents? Well, here we run into a problem, which is that the theory is, possesses no expansion parameter and is strongly coupled. And previously, people attempted to circumvent this problem by using a large n expansion, so promoting fermions to have n components. However, as Sung Sik has taught us, the large n expansion fails for the present problem. And actually, at present, it is not even known if a large n limit of the theory exists. After this, we were kind of stuck. So what we decided to do with Subir was to just do uncontrolled calculations to search for new physics for evidence of renormalization of critical exponents. So we did an expansion around RPA up to three-loop level. That's how far we had to go to search for new physics. And we had a lot of fun with these diagrams. But at the end of the day, we saw that at three loops, the dynamical critical exponent remains unrenormalized from its RPA value of 3. We don't actually understand the reason for this non-renormalization. Whereas the fermion anomalous dimension acquires a finite but numerically small value. So we're hoping that there might be some 1 over 4 pi expansion underlying all of this. But this was actually kind of surprising news because for 10 years people thought that this exponent is 0. And this exponent enters a number of physical properties, such as, for example, tunneling density of states. So here we have, for example, a physical prediction that the tunneling density of states at the quantum critical point is power law suppressed. All right. This is not entirely satisfactory because we are relying on an uncontrolled expansion. There is a way to make this controlled, which is to promote. This is getting very technical, so I'll be very brief here. So one promotes the kinetic term of the order parameter, which is analytic, to a non-analytic form shown here. Of course, physically, this parameter epsilon is equal to 1, and everything is analytic in momenta. But turns out that the theory is controlled when the parameter epsilon is small. And one, in fact, in this region epsilon much smaller than one, there is a dimensionless coupling constant which flows to an infrared stable fixed point at which one can do controlled calculations. In fact, there is also a kind of a slightly modified expansion where one takes also the number of flavors to be large. This expansion is, we are sure, is controlled, whereas this one, without the large N modification, we are not entirely sure. Okay, but in any case, one can go ahead and one can calculate critical exponents, and at three loop order, one finds indeed a non-zero fermion anomalous dimension. This was shown by the MIT group. So this is kind of a controlled version of the calculation I showed you earlier. Okay, so things got pretty technical by now, but I hope I convinced you that we have a pretty good understanding of the non-Fermi liquid properties of these critical Fermi surface states. And in the remaining time, let me come back to the issue I raised in the very beginning, which is, we have this critical Fermi surface state, but is it actually stable to pairing, to Cooper pairing? Okay, and turns out that when we try to answer this question within this two-patch formalism that I introduced, we run into some serious difficulties. Namely, if you look at the renormalization of four fermion operators in the two-patch theory, we find very strong infrared divergences. And the appearance of these divergences means that there is something wrong with our renormalization group procedure. And actually, we know what is wrong. Remember, in our two-patch RG, we are starting with these two patches, and we are attempting to shrink both the width and the thickness of the patches in each RG step. What does it mean, shrink? Shrink is RG parlance for integrate out excitations. So we are attempting to integrate out excitations in these shaded areas here. But some of those excitations live exactly on the Fermi surface, so cannot be integrated out. So the integrating them out is illegal. So that's where our problems are coming from. So to solve these problems, we need to modify our renormalization group procedure a little bit. And here we follow an idea initially introduced by Dam Son in his treatment of quark pairing in dense quark matter. So the idea is the following. We're again going to begin by dividing the Fermi surface into pairs of antipodal patches. And in each RG step now, we are going to further subdivide each patch into two smaller patches. And they're not going to integrate out any gapless excitations. And furthermore, we are going to keep couplings between these different pairs of patches. And we are going to monitor how those couplings evolve under the renormalization group process. Okay, so what type of couplings should be kept? Turns out that there are only two types of couplings which are kinematically allowed. These are the BCS processes and the forward scattering processes. Since I am focusing on the problem of electron pairing, let me focus on these BCS interactions. Okay. Thanks. Okay. So we have this BCS scattering, interpatch scattering processes. And let me just quickly remind you what happens to those BCS scattering processes in an ordinary Fermi liquid. In an ordinary Fermi liquid, the RG flow of this BCS for Fermi interactions is governed by this one loop diagram here, which gives rise to this flow equation, which tells us that if you start with repulsive interactions in the Cooper channel, they just renormalize to zero. But if you start with attractive interactions in the Cooper channel, they run away to minus infinity, which signals an instability of the system to electron pairing and superconductivity. OK, so how is this Fermi liquid result modified when we have this gapless boson fluctuations around? How is this equation modified? And it turns out that the leading modification comes from this simple process where the order single boson exchange mediates a BCS interaction between the fermions. So before we perform this renormalization group step, this boson exchange mediates an intra-patch long-range interaction. However, after I perform the RG step, dividing each patch into two smaller patches, and simultaneously integrating out order parameter fluctuations in this range of momenta, this interaction becomes a short-range, local, inter-patch interaction. And this process, therefore, generates an extra contribution to the renormalization group flow of the inter-patch interactions V. So let me remind you that alpha is the coupling constant between the you have a coupling constant between the boson and fermion. Okay, so now we have this combined renormalization group equations for the inter-patch couplings and for the intra-patch coupling, and we should just go ahead and solve them. So let me tell you what the results are. First, the case of the quantum critical point in a metal, particularly this Ising-Nemetic transition. Here we find, first of all, that the order parameter fluctuations contribute an extra negative piece to the RG flow of the BCS scattering amplitude. So that agrees with our intuition. Order parameter fluctuations mediate an attractive interaction. And turns out that this extra piece results in the following flow, where no matter whether we initially start with a repulsive BCS interaction or an attractive BCS interaction, the interaction always runs away to minus infinity. So the system is always unstable to superconductivity. The quantum critical point is covered by a superconducting dome. And I can estimate how the gap of this superconductor depends on the coupling constant between the boson and the electrons, and it depends in a power law manner, which is a much larger gap than a BCS gap, which is exponentially small. So we have a quite strong superconductor here. Now we can compare the energy scale at which superconductivity sets in to an energy scale where the electrons lose coherence. And it turns out that the energy scale where superconductivity sets in is parametrically larger than the energy scale where electrons lose coherence, as long as we have this small control parameter epsilon. So in the region where our calculation is controlled, instead of a picture where we have this incoherent electron fan emerging from underneath the superconductor, we find that the incoherent regime is completely preempted by superconductivity. So the superconductor is somehow very strong. Pardon me?
What is the numerical value?
Yeah, epsilon. So this is just, there are some numerical values here, right? But epsilon is basically one. So when epsilon becomes one, these two energy scales become comparable, but we also lose analytical control of the problem. Yeah, yeah. So this is just yes. So there is a transition, but it now occurs in a superconductor, and it has exponents which are essentially, which depending on what the superconductor is, might be just exponents of the classical tuple Ising. Yeah. If it's a fully gapped superconductor. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Right. So remember, I initially asked this question that there is this competition between pairing glue and quasi-particle destruction at the quantum critical point. Well, here the pairing glue clearly wins, at least in the regime where we have control. Okay, so let me next quickly describe the situation for the spin on Fermi surface case. So here, instead of order parameter, we have a gauge field. And the gauge field fluctuations add an extra piece to the running of these inter-patch interactions, which is a positive piece. So gauge field fluctuations mediate repulsion, and so this is consistent. And now we solve this coupled RG equations. We find that the intra-patch coupling constant runs to a fixed point value. I already mentioned this. But now there are also perturbatively accessible fixed points for this BCS interaction V. There are actually two fixed points. There is an infrared stable fixed point and an infrared unstable fixed point. So as long as the interaction between the spin-ons is larger than this, as long as the attractive interaction is smaller than a critical value, the system flows to this infrared stable fixed point, which we associate with the spin-on Fermi surface phase. So the spin-on Fermi surface phase is stable against pairing, as long as the pairing strength is smaller than a critical value. But once we cross a critical value of the pairing interaction, the interaction V runs away to minus infinity. And this signals an instability to spin-on pairing. And we get a Z2 spin liquid state. So now, because we have this fixed point here, it means that the phase transition between the spin-on Fermi surface phase and the Z2 spin liquid phase is continuous. And we can calculate how the gap onsets across the transition, and it onsets in some nice power law manner. Okay, so there are some open questions. I guess I'm pretty much out of time, so maybe let me skip this. Let me go to my conclusions. So over the past few years, we've seen some progress and new challenges in understanding this critical Fermi surface state. Here I've presented a first theory of a superconducting instability of a quantum critical point in a two-dimensional metal. We see that pairing glue wins over quasi-particle destruction, and the transition is unstable to pairing, to superconductivity. So open questions are extensions of these results to other type of quantum critical points, in particular to spin density wave order, which is crucial to many of these materials. And I think Subir will probably mention that during his colloquium. There are a lot of open questions. Perhaps the most pressing one is to describe transport. We saw this linear T resistivity in many materials that I showed you. And essentially, this is still a mystery. And I think we also need to start thinking beyond this paradigm. So at this point, all our critical Fermi surface states involve an interaction of some gapless boson with a Fermi surface. And this is a complicated problem, and we are making progress on it. But perhaps we also need to think of other ideas for non-Fermi liquid physics. Thank you.
You're saying that you generate new interpatch couplings or interpatch. Can you repeat that?
Yes. So at each step in the RG, you are splitting your patch into two smaller patches. So
originally you had K minus K coupling, right?
Yes, K minus. So some scattering. So if this Q is in this range here, right, then before the RG step, this interaction would be an intra-patch interaction. It would scatter within the patch. But if Q is larger, but after the RG process, we shrink the size of the patch. So these processes now scatter between the patches rather than within a patch.
Between two adjoint patches.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
do you have a situation where you get the more patch, the 4-patch, 8-patch, they became almost like one, you know, you.
So this
it's
is
like actually, a functional RGU.
So here, the funny thing about this RG is that at each step we do actually get more and more patches, right? Because
yeah.
we are subdividing.
But at the end, you do get a functional RG. Looks like at the end, your RG equation is pretty simple. Looks like you only have 2 patches. You don't need to worry about, you know, the common constant is dependent on the angle, you know.
Yes. So here I assumed rotational symmetry.
Oh.
In principle, one can very easily modify these flow equations.
Here, the key point, you only have a nearest neighbor patch. But is that you don't worry about, you know, in the first, you have a coupling between nearest neighbor patch. The next RT, you know, second neighbor, third neighbor,
yes.
fourth neighbor, they all appear, they become very, very complicated.
Yes, but those higher order processes are already described by this.
Okay.
So interpatch coupling, right? It's generated from interpatch coupling at each step, and then the interpatch coupling, you know, this is kind of smooth scattering function of angle, and
right.
it just, you know, this is just Fermi-Liquid term.
Oh yeah, Vm. Oh, I see.
Yeah, this
okay.
is just Fermi-Liquid term. So this can be formulated in terms of
yeah.
large angle scattering.
Yeah.
Are there more questions?
So how do you would you get a feeling for the size of this this V, the parameterly tuned attraction?
For
because this is like an external parameter you put in your system, right?
For the spin-on Fermi surface problem, or
for
the,
example, yeah.
Yeah, for the spin-on Fermi surface problem, it's extremely difficult to estimate, right? Because you are going from electrons or spins to spin-ons, and then you have to ask, you know, what is the coupling constant between. What is the short-range interaction between those spin-ons? So maybe in some mean field type treatment, starting with these slate particles, you could try to estimate it. When you do kind of variational Monte Carlo studies
mm-hmm.
of the triangular lattice, and you put in some pairing term for the spin-ons, oftentimes a pairing is favored. So there's been work by Sentel and Tarun and Nandini Triverdi, where they looked at all kinds of such kind of mean field pairings and took variational Monte Carlo, so after Gutzwiller projection, and I think they find some kind of interesting nodal pairing of spin-ons is favored. So that's kind of perhaps reason to believe that there is some attractive short-range interaction present in the microscopics.
For the nematic transition?
Yeah, for the nematic transition, in principle, we can start with V equal to zero, so start with the 4-Fermi interaction just coming entirely from, things, you know, entirely coming from order parameter fluctuations, and then this V will be generated, right? So in that case, there is, one doesn't need to add a V on top to drive pairing.
So here the three level scaling dimension of V is zero.
That's correct.
So it's like Shankar RG.
Yes.
So the angle doesn't scale.
Yeah, so somehow this type of treatment combines the two RGs, the two patch RG and the Shankar RG. So the V is in some sense described via the Shankar RG, this kind of large angle scattering processes.
But we know that, you know, this non-conic behavior is not comparable. I mean, it's not corresponding for the.
I think for the interpatch interaction, it's correct that within a patch, this 4-Fermi term does indeed have is irrelevant. But interpatch terms, I mean, the system when epsilon is equal to zero is basically a marginal Fermi liquid. So it has to be very close to a Fermi liquid. So the bare scaling dimension of V better be zero.
But for small but non-zero epsilon, you need to.
Oh, very good. Good question. So you're asking. So I had this. You're asking about, there is a term, linear NP.
Yeah, order that's one.
And yes, so it turns out that this term is parametrically, in the regime when epsilon is much smaller than one, this term is parametrically smaller than these two terms. Because this goes as, essentially, V goes as square root of epsilon. So this is epsilon, and this will be epsilon to the 3/2. So it can be neglected.
I see, for small epsilon.
Yeah.
I wonder when the shape of a Fermi surface, like the geometry or curvature, play any role in your treatment.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
The geometry of Fermi surface.
So
the curvature.
Yeah, the curvature is fundamental.
The curvature is fundamental. That's correct. Now, for the rest, just to simplify the treatment, I assume the circular Fermi surface. But I think that can be very easily. That can be very easily taken care of. One can consider general, non-circular case.
You started to talk about the U1 field. You started to, you're going to say something like the U1 charge is the difference of right-handed minus left-handed correlation. You started to draw.
No. This is not the charge, but the flux of the emergent gauge field is related to the spin chirality on the triangle.
So it's still the U. You just want to say the U1 has to be larger.
It's not the physical electron charge.
Then there has to be some. I mean,
there is some issue of kind of.
What would you expect? It's a property of a lattice then, and other lattices might give you a different gauge group.
No, you can do this decomposition on arbitrary lattice. It's a.
I can do the decomposition with an arbitrary gauge.
Yes. So you're asking what type of physics is sympathetic?
Yeah. Which physics would select?
Yeah. I think this type of charge spin separation. You know, this I don't immediately see how to do this with a. With an EA gauge field. There's a very natural that there is a charge boson, and then you have a.
You can always write something u to the minus 1 u. You can always kind of you factorize something. You just have to use some conjugate things on either side of the block.
This is by far the simplest thing that you can. Well, I guess Z2 is a bit simpler.
Yeah,
but
Z2 is slightly more natural. But then, if something selects something, if the physics not the electrons themselves, but some aspects that maybe the thing fits best on this lattice, then you can presumably expect that some more complicated lattice choice might prefer to have U2 or something like that. Right? I mean, once it's disconnect, once the choice of the gauge group is not the associated with electron number, then one wants to explain why some gauge group is energetically preferred of the
other. So it's Hamiltonian dependent on the state dependent.
Yeah, right. So then it could be then it should be looked for in some energetic.
For example,
so
valence spin.
To the energetic, it's proximity to the Mott transition.
Mm-hmm.
If you're very close to the Mott transition, then this U1 state with the spin on Fermi surface is energetically very well motivated. It's energetically preferred, and lots of calculations have been done to show that. That's an energetic state.
So, like in variational Monte Carlo, for instance, this state is favored.
Or in DMRG, that actually.
I think that the natural choice cannot be Z2 because here if we do this decomposition is general U1 or SUN, so the problem then becomes whether there's some like spin on Harry instability. If there is such kind of instability, then it will be fixed to Z2.
Still, you're getting an emergent charge.
So you can have these Z2 things. So for example, with Sentel, we work on something we call an orthogonal metal, where B is just a Z2 spin as well, and the charge is carried by the F. So then you get a very different space, which is almost like a thermoliquid, but not quite. So I mean, there are many possibilities, but energetically, this seems to be preferred near the Mott transition.
Yeah.
So perhaps if there are further questions, then we might defer to copy. So let's thank Matthew.